This is Car Expert.
So I think, you know what, 144, it would have been a lot of money if it was sold as a Holden. I reckon it's actually reasonable.
They all have cork on the transmission tunnel, which is a nod to Mazda's past as a cork company based out of Hiroshima.
This is a mid or rear engine, rear wheel drive, V8 Stingray looking spaceship.
G'day, my name's Mandy Turner, and g'day to Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy.
And James Wong.
Hey, Mandy. Hey, Mike.
Moko, you have been in a hydrogen car this week. Not exactly a common sight around Australia at the moment. What were you driving?
Yeah, I was up in Canberra for the launch of the Hyundai Nexo, which is a hydrogen fuel cell SUV. There's going to be 20 of them in the country run by the ACT government as part of a wind farm deal. The ACT government is actually the most progressive of all the state and territory governments when it comes to incentivizing electrified vehicle rollout. So basically, there is a giant refueler in Canberra that uses wind energy to run an electrolysis process, which is water and then electricity going through that water to isolate and create hydrogen that is then pressurized and pumped into vehicles. Hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are basically there's an onboard power station where hydrogen in tanks causes a chemical reaction when it meets oxygen and creates electricity to drive motors, with the only tailpipe emission being water. So it's another zero emissions technology. Unlike a battery electric car, you don't need to have a heavy storage battery on board because the car is making the power as it goes along. Widely seen as the future for heavy industry and logistics because of the payload benefits and the range benefits, not so much for smaller cars where BEVs are largely seen as the future. But it was really fascinating to be able to drive these vehicles. I mean, there were going to be 20 public servants just driving around Canberra all day long in these Nexos. This is not a science experiment. This is not future tech. As we speak, there are government staff driving hydrogen fuel cell Hyundais through the main streets of Canberra, which I think is absolutely fantastic. And on that note, Toyota just this week also announced 20 Mirai FCEVs for Melbourne fleets and its own Melbourne-based refueler as well. So hydrogen fuel cell is certainly not getting the attention that battery electric is, but for a brief week in Australia, at the very least, it's definitely had its share of the limelight.
How did you find the experience of driving a hydrogen car? Are they sort of powerful? Do they make any sound?
So the best way to think of a hydrogen fuel cell car is it actually is an EV. So it's an electric motor that drives the wheels. It's just that the EV gets its power from a hydrogen fuel cell rather than from a battery that's storing electricity that was put into it from a wall plug. So it drives just like an EV, quiet, smooth, relatively punchy, instantaneous torque. The only difference is that it's purifying the air that comes in and it's spitting water out the back. So it's a bit lighter than a typical EV. And the filling is a very different experience. It takes 5 minutes to fill it up. There's a 150-litre tank that stores 6.6 kilograms of pressurized hydrogen at 700 bar. It looks just like an LPG tank. You drive up, you stick your bowser in, leave it for 5 minutes, your tank is full. You can do 650 Ks per refill and then go straight back to the depot and do it all again. So in some ways, it's not like an EV. There isn't some super long charge time to worry about. There's not so much range anxiety to worry about. But it's also not like an EV because infrastructure is few and far between. And you actually do have to put a liquid in a vehicle, albeit in highly pressurized form. So it's a very unique form of transport. Hasn't got the cut through that BEVs have yet. But nevertheless, extraordinarily interesting. And given Australia wants to be a hydrogen superpower, exporting that energy to our Asian neighbors to the north as a green technology moving forward, I think it's really got some legs.
Yeah, that's really exciting. Yeah. Something else that's exciting, JWo, you are officially famous, or actually I should say more famous. With that hair, of course. You have been named an ambassador for Drive Against Depression. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a really exciting thing. So for those who don't know, Drive Against Depression is a charity run by a few people in the industry that we work with, just spreading the word to start the conversation about mental illness. And, you know, specifically for this charity, it's through a shared love of cars and driving, which I think we can all relate to. Paul Marrick has been the ambassador for a while and he's got a child on the way, he's got business commitments and all sorts of things. So myself and actually a friend of mine, Chelsea Angelo, who's a race car driver, have stepped up and taken over the ambassadorship. And we had a recent drive day over the weekend which was in collaboration with Berwick Ford. So a guy named Paul Webb, who's an avid supporter of the charity, works as a sales manager at the Ford dealership down in Berwick. And so he's done a couple of days where they've basically hosted everybody in the morning and then we set off in our drive. And yeah, it was a really good day and we had a really good turnout. It's good to see so many people relating to the message, especially after the last year that we've all had throughout Australia where, you know, we weren't able to do a lot of things. A lot of people love driving, weren't able to do much of that. Excuse me. And so it's good. I'm really excited to just be part of an awesome cause and continue to meet people, share stories, start conversations. And, you know, I love helping people in all senses of it, you know, being somebody that gives advice and stuff on cars and helping people make their next purchase is one small way that I can sort of contribute to society and help out people that I know and don't know. And I think that, you know, this cause is perhaps a more meaningful way where I can make really strong connections with people that have gone through some really tough times. So I'm just really excited and thankful that the charity's chosen me to begin with as somebody that they want as the face and, you know, somebody that's driving their message, not to use a pun. And yeah, just to be a part of something so great. It's really nice. So yeah.
I can attest to the efficacy of the Drive Against Depression charity. It's a brilliant organization. I've had my own mental health demons for many years. And I can say how important it is to somebody with mental health issues, depression in my case, that the ability to be able to go and meet people who have similar issues to you in a car, and you've all got a mutual love of cars, you're in the outdoors, you're going to great cafes and meetups as part of the drives that they do on a given weekend. It's a really nice way to clear your head, to be with like-minded people, to take some of the anxiety and stress away, to talk about the issues that are on your mind in a safe place with things that you're passionate and people that you're passionate about. It's a brilliant idea, and it's one that's, you know, hopefully got a lot of resonance to people. And, you know, kudos to you for getting involved, Wangi, I have to say, but it's just a brilliant organization. And if you are feeling down and if you are, you know, going through battles and you do like cars, Drive Against Depression, go have a look on Google or wherever else, look into it. And, I highly recommend it. It's a brilliant organization.
Yeah, nicely said, Moko. Is there any details for the next Drive Against Depression event, Joe?
No, not yet, but they tend to do like a quarterly drive. So we've now done summer and autumn, and I guess the next one is winter. So I would say it's somewhere between June and August we'll have our next one. So if you stay tuned to the Drive Against Depression website, also across my socials, I'll be sharing whatever information I can get through. So just stay tuned. We're looking forward to the next one. So hopefully more people can join us next time.
Yeah, cool. We'll give it a mention on the podcast next time too if you are listening. It's time for this week's news. Probably the biggest news of the week, Joe. We finally got pricing for the 2021 Chevrolet Corvette, and it's a little eye-watering, I think.
Yeah, well, we've been waiting for this for a long time. So before Holden retired, they promised the Corvette was coming. Then Holden retired itself. Then we didn't know whether the Corvette was coming. Then HSV or now General Motors Specialty Vehicles formed, and they said it's coming. So I almost forgot about it because I just wasn't sure what was going to happen to it, to be honest. But they finally confirmed pricing this week. And so how much do you think guys think it's going to be? Or well, you guys probably already know now because we've all read the news. So I'll break the silence. It's going to start from just over $144,000 before on-road costs. Actually, $144,990 before on-road costs. So $145,000 is not bad considering what performance is on offer. So it will be powered by a 6.2-litre naturally aspirated V8 tucked behind the cabin, developing 364 kilowatts and 630 newton meters of torque sent to the rear wheels via an 8-speed dual-clutch automatic. This thing seems like a bit of a monster. So it can do 0 to 100 in just 2.9 seconds, making it very, very close to a Porsche 911 Turbo, which arguably costs a lot more. Looking at the price here, I think it's $473,900. So that's what, three and a bit times more?
Jesus.
Yeah, which is crazy. And it's actually going to be still built in factory right-hand drive. So unlike the Silverado, which gets converted in Clayton by Walkinshaw, the Corvette will continue to be manufactured by Chevrolet in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and manufactured in right-hand drive as originally planned. So that probably helped get the price down a little bit, because I imagine if the vehicle had to be converted, there'd be costs associated with that. So yes, Moco.
It's still, what is it, 30 grand cheaper than a C63 AMG coupe. I think when we think about potential cars to crush up against this, you think about that V8 German muscle coupe. I reckon a Corvette is a heck of a lot more rare and interesting and dynamic and certainly quicker in a straight line than that C63 is. So I think, you know what, 144, it would have been a lot of money if it was sold as a Holden, but as it stands, I reckon it's actually reasonable.
Yeah, I think it's actually really good value, and they're going to offer both coupe and convertible versions. So, and it will also come in two guises. So there's 2LT and 3LT. The convertible commands about a $15,000 premium over the coupe. So as standard across the range, they're bringing the Z51 performance pack, which is, an option in the US. And basically it gets things like a dual mode exhaust, adaptive magnetic ride control, larger brakes, electronic limited slip differential, a more aggressive front splitter and rear spoiler, and better cooling for the engine. So they've really spec'd this thing to the nines. And when you think about, as Moco said before, against some of the European competition that the Corvette's going against, it's sort of like a cut price exotic supercar, because it's a mid or rear engine, rear wheel drive V8 Stingray looking, you know, spaceship.
Beast. And
yeah, exactly right. I actually think that they're going to sell more than they're going to be able to bring over, because at that price, there's not a lot of options anymore. The next C63 is going to go to a four-cylinder plug-in hybrid setup, which we'll get to later in the news section. So the direct rivals are few and far between, especially at this price point. And I'm really keen to see them out on the roads, because I reckon people love the Corvette brand on its own. It sort of transcends the Chevrolet branding. And I know, Moco, you said before, if it was a Holden, it would probably be very expensive. But the Corvette brand has such a long history. There's a lot of a really big following from motoring enthusiasts of all ages and backgrounds, because, you know, it dates back 50, 60 years. So I reckon, like the Mustang, how the Mustang sort of made the muscle car mainstream here, I reckon this could make the mid-engine supercar mainstream, I guess. If that can even be mainstream. Yes.
Have we got dates for when it's coming to Australia yet?
It's meant to be here in the third quarter of 2021. So that's what? That's August, between August and October.
Okay.
So not far away.
Not far away at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
Moco, some sad news for Ford. The Mondeo badge is being retired. It was already retired here in Australia, but it's also happening throughout the rest of the world as well.
What an absolute unmitigated tragedy this is. Not really. Ford Mondeo, not exactly their height of excitement, but yes, so it won't live past 2022 as the company kills off the long-running sedan or sedan/hatch and wagon. It's going to be replaced by a high-riding car of some sort, be it an SUV or a Subaru Outback-style wagon on stilts. We're not quite sure. There's a quote here in Automotive News Europe from the brand saying the market segment in which the Mondeo competes has been dwindling for years and is down 80% since 2000, which kind of brings it all home. And you can see how vehicles like this really are yesterday's news. So, you know, the Mondeo, it's not exactly the most sexy nameplate, but let's be honest, it's been around a very long time. A lot of people have memories attached to that Mondeo badge, including those in Australia. So bit of a sad day, I guess, to see that go.
Do you reckon it was a bit of an underrated car?
A massively underrated car. Yeah. I really like the outgoing Mondeo. In terms of, it's sort of a shame that Australians never bought wagons sort of in the last 10 or 15 years, because that Mondeo wagon was a monster. It was enormous inside. It had a decent diesel. It rode pretty well. It was dirt cheap. You could get great deals on them because nobody wanted them. A little bit of an underachiever. And that wasn't just an Australian thing, obviously. So I think it's the market's loss.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you guys have any memories of Mondeo at all?
I rode in a few as taxis. That's probably about the
Yeah, pretty much the same as me.
I have very early memories of computer games playing using the Mondeo because I used to play
Mondeo on a computer game.
What kind of computer games were you playing, dude?
Yeah.
I used to play Toka, which was the British Touring Car Championship, as a computer game. And so the Mondeo, the Vectra, and the Renault Laguna were the main main cars that you could use in that.
There's no more Vectra, there's no more Laguna, and there's no more Mondeo.
I know. So that's some of my earliest memories of the Mondeo. And actually my uncle had a couple as business car or work cars over the last 5 or 10 years, and he absolutely loved them. He had a previous generation and a current generation one, loved the diesel, the economy, the comfort. And then when he recently had to get another fleet car, he wasn't able to get a Mondeo anymore. So he was actually really disappointed because he loved how versatile it was. He ended up getting an X-Trail, which he already doesn't like. But I did try to tell him to get something else, but he didn't listen, and now he's paying the price for it. So the Mondeo, I feel, has always been an underrated car. I actually have relatives in Spain that have really loved the Mondeo as well because it's very popular over there. It's just a shame that it seems globally people aren't buying them. The Ford Fusion in the US went the similar way a couple of years ago. It's basically the same car underneath. So it just seems like everyone is getting SUVs and not buying these cars anymore, so it's a shame.
Oh boy, J-Wo, the turbocharged V8 is no longer going to be in the Mercedes-AMG C63. The sad news just keeps continuing.
Yeah, this is probably one of the industry's worst kept secrets because we've sort of known this for a while. But so Mercedes-AMG has confirmed that the next generation C63 will drop the 4-litre biturbo V8 that is in the current car and sub it out for a plug-in hybrid system featuring a 2-litre turbocharged 4-cylinder engine as well as a high-output electric motor and battery pack. So what they are doing is basically taking the engine out of the current A45, which is the most powerful 4-cylinder production engine in the world, and in that it makes about 315 kilowatts. And then putting it with a plug-in hybrid system. So we're not sure how much power it's going to make just yet, but we reckon it'll at least match, if not better, the outputs of the current V8. So you can expect, around 375, 400 kilowatts and around 700 to 800 newton meters. Mercedes-AMG promises that the total power and torque from this new powertrain will surpass current comparable models with non-hybrid engines. And it's also previewed the future of its performance models with the AMG GT four-door. That's a bit of a mouthful. So when they revealed that as a concept, they did a plug-in hybrid version of that 4-litre V8, which will probably still be used for larger models like the AMG GT or maybe the next E63, for example. But for small models like the E-Class, it seems like this new 4-cylinder powertrain will help them get their emissions down because it's a very popular model globally, particularly in Australia. And given what you can do with electrified powertrains these days, it'll probably be more powerful. I'd say they'll bring in all-wheel drive and it'll be an absolute rocket. So the only thing you'll really miss is maybe the V8 sound. I don't know about you guys, but
totally miss it.
Well, I'm wading through the extraordinarily waffly press release at the moment. Bloody hell, Daimler makes some of the most waffly press releases known to humanity. There's a line in here that says, and of course, the hallmark AMG sound is also part of the package with additional hardware, brackets, loudspeakers, shaker, sound generator, for example, and the newly composed authentic AMG sound experience. Mercedes-AMG is also driving into the future in a highly emotively appealing electric way. So the company says it's going to try and make this plug-in hybrid sound as amazing as the previous iterations of the C63 have. I have my doubts, but at least they're focusing on the aural experience because, as Mandy, as you said, the sound is everything in this car, and it may not have that rough, grumbly, barking V8, but hopefully it still sounds interesting, right?
It better. Just a quick follow-up from last week. We touched on the 2021 Subaru Outback stop sale problem. We weren't too sure what that problem was, but now we do, Mocha.
Yeah, so it has recalled 1,982 cars to fix a problem with the pre-collision warning system. So there's a quote here saying, in some cases, the stereo camera, which Subaru calls EyeSight, may misrecognize roadside objects and or miscalculate the traveling distance of an oncoming vehicle, unexpectedly activating pre-collision braking. The likelihood of these symptoms occurring is low. So in other words, the car might just randomly brake itself, brake, which obviously wouldn't be very fun. So no doubt that they're recalling that. Potentially a dangerous situation, it has to be said, especially if there's a car sitting right on your clacker. And there was actually a separate Subaru Outback recall of a smaller number of Outbacks, 256, with a potentially problematic electronic brake booster. Now, look, let's not get too carried away here. The Outback has just launched in new generation form. Quite often there are some kinks to be ironed out, some wrinkles to be ironed away in the beginning of a model. So hopefully it's just a couple of the recalls at the beginning and then all the problems are solved from here on in. But not a great start for that vehicle. Long awaited, extremely popular, two big recalls in the first month or so on sale. Not what you would call a great beginning for the Outback.
Yeah, too right. And lastly, Moko, just a couple of hours ago at time of recording, you wrote an article called How Australia's Federal Opposition Proposes to Slash EV Prices.
Yeah.
How is it going to do that?
Well, old mate Anthony Albanese, the Federal Opposition leader, did a press conference today at Liverpool Nissan alongside Chris Bowen, the Federal Climate Change Shadow Minister, talking about what they're going to do to bolster EV sales. Of course, the ALP went to last federal election in 2019 saying they wanted half of all cars to be electrified by 2030, prompting the Morrison government to retort with that memorable "they're going to end the weekend" campaign about how they're going to force tradies to have electric utes, etc., etc. Needless to say, the ALP's previous policy didn't cut through because they lost the election. So they've decided to tweak it and fettle it and basically get Australia somewhere on track with what the rest of the world is doing to incentivize electric car pickup. I mean, EV sales in Australia last year were 0.7% of the market, and that's nowhere compared to pretty much everywhere else in the world of similar socioeconomic status. So the things that it's proposed aren't seismic. It's going to remove the fringe benefits taxes for fleet buyers, which could save a Nissan Leaf buyer upwards of $9,000, according to its estimates. And it's also going to remove tariffs for private buyers. But then again, it's worth considering that most sources of EVs we already have free trade agreements with, so there would already be no tariffs on those. But that could save you up to $2,000 on a Nissan Leaf. It's also funding some community batteries for energy storage to help out with the extra demand for EVs. Now, unfortunately, there aren't any policies like direct buyer subsidies from government. It's also not incentivizing infrastructure, charging infrastructure directly. So for mine, this policy does kind of only go about halfway to where it needs to go, but certainly compared to where the current government sits, it is definitely more advanced in incentivizing EV. So let's hope at the very least this puts electric cars back on the table, makes a conversation out of them again, and maybe prompts the coalition government to also come up with a policy of its own.
It's certainly a start anyway. Exactly. So they're heading in the right direction. Yeah. If you would like to read up more news, head to carexpert.com.au. We've spoken about this a couple of times in the past on the podcast, the Car Expert Experience Centre, a place where you can see, touch, sit and drive cars without the pressure of a car salesperson in your ear or in your face. It opened on Sunday. Moko, you were there. How did it all go?
Actually opened on Saturday.
I was there
for Saturday. I flew up from Sydney. I'm obviously based down here with the team in Melbourne, as are you guys, but I was up there in Sydney at the Warringah Mall near Manly, lovely part of the world. And it was a brilliant weekend. So I did 3 days over the first stint before coming home. And I have to say, none of us quite knew how it would go. We were all a little bit unsure because as far as we can tell, no publication has ever really done anything like this. As you said, Mandy, it's all about, you know, being a brand agnostic, safe place for people to come and get information on vehicles and go for a test drive without any of those pressure points. We're certainly not anti-dealer. We're certainly not opposed to any of those types of businesses, but we just thought, you know what, we might be able to throw something a bit different into the mix. And the feedback we've got so far has been excellent. I know we had close to 300 people coming through on the first day, more came through on the Sunday. And so we probably, you know, close to 1,000 people over that first weekend would have come down. some of the conversations we're able to have. We had Al Bors and Anthony Crawford and myself there, and Scott Colley did a stint, just to be able to talk to people. People come in a little bit unsure. They sort of walk in. There's 17 cars, 12 brands, and they'll walk in and say, you know, what are you all about? What are you doing here? Are you an MG showroom? Are you a Mitsubishi showroom? A Nissan showroom? Are you trying to sell me cars? What is your deal, I guess? And who could blame anybody for thinking that? So once you explain to people what we're up to, that we've got a number of different manufacturers with their products here to look at, that we're not biased, that we're not trying to sell you anything, that we're just here to give you information, people really relax. And then they really enjoy, I think, being able to talk to us. You know, and there's plenty of people that would love to sit in cars, test the legroom, play around with the screens, do all those sorts of things that you would expect them to do in their own pace. We had quite a few people inquiring about the possibilities of a test drive in Valet at the Westfield Shopping Centre. We've got duplicate cars out the back that are there for that purpose. So we've started that process as well. And by and large, I have to say I was really, really, really happy. And I think most of us were happy. The feedback has been largely great. And, you know, it's such early days for us. We're still working on, you know, just problem solving and getting rid of any of those little kinks that you'll find when you do launch something new. But by and large, and I have to say, the effort of the Sydney team to get this place up and running, to have it looking as good as it does, it's in an old City Beach surf store. So it's an enormous open double-entranced facility with wooden floors, beautifully lit. The cars are laid out nicely. There's great signage everywhere. There's a desk welcoming you, which is at its best when Anthony Crawford is there, because he is the most welcoming man in the world, as we all know. Just phenomenal. And, you know, as I said, some of the conversations we had, you know, it's market research that goes both ways, right? Because it's great market research for the manufacturers, because they're getting consideration from foot traffic and people that just weren't expecting to see cars on a given day. But then from my perspective, I'm actually getting to interface with real in-market car buyers, you know, constantly in a way that I very rarely do. Usually it's, you know, you might help your friends or family out, but here we get to actually talk and engage with just random people who've come in to have a look. And that's incredibly valuable for us and hopefully for consumers and punters moving forward too. So what began as an idea has morphed into a reality, and it's incredibly exciting.
It's awesome. Do you know, so the majority of people who were walking in were thinking, yeah, I want to buy a car and I want to know more information, or was the majority of people like, oh, I'm just keen to find out a little bit of information, just on the fence at the moment? What did you find?
The majority of people over the first weekend, I think, were people who just happened to be in Warringah Mall. We're next door to David Jones and there's a food court right nearby. And I think a lot of the people were just people there doing their shopping, and they just happened to see car expert signs everywhere and a bunch of cars. And so a lot of people came in, they weren't necessarily looking for a vehicle, but they were just intrigued to know what it was. There were certainly some people that heard about it and got wind of it who were absolutely in market. I know we had a guy come in and have a look at one car and went for a test drive in the first 30 minutes of opening and actually bought a vehicle at a dealership up the road based on that. So there's definitely some people. They tended to be the people that are car expert readers or viewers and actually knew to expect it. There were those that just wanted to come and say hi because they liked what we do. There were people who came, who saw it, asked what we were, and then later came back with family or friends who they knew that were interested in buying a car. So we were already starting to see those sorts of referrals coming through. I think initially, because nobody was expecting to see it, you know, it wasn't hugely publicized. We certainly talked about it, but, you know, the majority of people probably didn't know that this was coming, and it was a City Beach surf store until not too long ago. So I think a lot of people probably would have, you know, formed initial opinions, and they might come back later once they've actually had the time to consider what they want to do with the CEEC. Yeah. So it was really, really interesting looking at the spread of people. But I think in reality, everybody has a relationship with cars. And even if you're not looking for a new car, you probably, in fact, you certainly know somebody who is. So the notion that you won't have questions and things. The other one that was really interesting to me was, I mainly hung out at the front entrance at the desk near the two electric cars we have. We have a Nissan Leaf and an MG ZS-EV. And a lot of people were coming in with questions about electric vehicles. How do I charge it? How much does it cost to charge it? You know, should I buy one? What range can I expect? All these questions. And it really taught me that, you know, there's still a lack of awareness among buyers around how EVs function. And it was really great to be able to maybe, you know, changed in perceptions, talked to people about whether the EV might be right for them or not. By no means is the EV the right choice for everybody, but it was nice to be able to put people's minds at ease in that sense as well. So a really broad spread, different ages too, from 10-year-old kids who just were fascinated with cars through to elderly couples who wanted to downsize, all the way across it from families to singles. The demographic spread was really broad. And, you know, there really wasn't any particular demo that wasn't represented over the course of the few days I was there.
Was there a certain particular popular model that people drew to?
Well, the EVs were probably the ones that surprised me. I reckon a good proportion of people coming in were curious about those. We have a Hyundai Palisade in there that got a lot of attention, especially with the third seating row. People really, really enjoyed that. At the other end of the spectrum, we had the little Suzuki Jimny. And obviously, I'm a bit biased because I own a Jimny. So people were loving that. And I was able to give some particularly good advice on that car. We had a number of dual cab utes in there as well. And obviously, given market trends, the dual cab utes are where a lot of the attention's going. So the D-Max, the Navara, the Ranger, and the Triton are in there. So there were plenty of people interested in those. And then a couple of the lower profile brands. We have a Renault Captur in there. We have a Citroen C3. These are manufacturers that perhaps struggle to sell cars to the same degree as other manufacturers do. And I think they're benefiting it because they're getting consideration they may not otherwise get. So by no means, no car was ignored, but there were certainly some that seemed to have people gravitating to them more than others.
How long is the CEEC going to be open for?
3 months is the initial period.
Wow.
Obviously, there is a lot of water to go under the bridge until we determine exactly, you know, what the future will look like for the program. But this is very much billed as our first crack. You know, this is not only a place for us to get this idea off the ground, but we're going to learn a heck of a lot over the next period. So, you know, obviously timelines and things are still a bit up in the air. But this iteration will be there for the best part of 3 months, so during up until June. So if you are in that part of Sydney and in the Manly area, you should definitely head down and have a look. You'll be able to speak to some of us car expert staffers, look at cars to your heart's content and give us as much feedback as you like, because that's really what we're into.
Yeah, awesome. There's a link on the homepage if you want to click on that and find out more as well. Australia's most affordable Renault, the 2021 Captur, is here, and Scott Colley has driven it. Hello, Scully.
Hello, guys. How are we?
Very good, thank you. The Captur has been around for a little while here, but how important is it for Renault Australia now?
It is very important for Renault Australia right now. Renault has just handed over from being distributed by the factory to being distributed by Atiko, which also sells LDV among other brands in Australia. But also it's had some cars here that have kind of sort of competed in popular segments and not quite made an impact. And the Captur is finally the car that it's really been waiting for, because it is like a fashionable, correctly sized, correctly priced, well-specced alternative to a Ford Puma or a Toyota CHR, among other cars. And it hits the right notes in that segment in a way that none of the cars before it did. So it's finally got the tools to sell a lot of them. It's just now down to whether it actually can.
Scully, I remember the old Renault Captur was fairly popular in Europe and certainly looked okay, but it kind of underwhelmed me. I found like it was a pretty half-assed car. I don't know. There were a lot of things that it didn't do as well as it probably should have. But this new one looks $1 million and it appears to address a lot of the shortfalls that the old one had. Would that be an accurate assessment based on your drive?
That's pretty bang on. I know you've had a quick spin at it as well, Mike, and I spent very limited time in the last Captur, not the one that we've just reviewed, and I hated every second of it. It was a really, really disappointing car. Whereas this one, for one, Renault has finally committed to its styling direction and made it look like a really premium little car. It's got real presence to it from the outside. I particularly love that the front fenders are quite flared and there's also a proper air vent sort of tucked in behind them. It has the looks to back up this idea that French cars are a little bit different, a little bit more maybe premium than a Japanese or another brand. But the biggest change is the one that's come under the bonnet. Renault actually said to us that it has brought the more powerful engine. So it's a 1.3-litre engine with 270 newton metres of torque and 110 kilowatts. And it actually brought that engine on the back of feedback on the last car, because people would take it for a test drive and go, look, it's fine, but I don't really like the engine. There's not enough grunt. So they've really listened and decided that it's time to do it properly.
Is this turbocharged?
It's turbocharged. It's a four cylinder. And it's actually the underneath the Captor shares a lot with the Duke, but this is a more powerful engine we don't get in the Duke in Australia, so it's quite unique.
Cool. Take us through the interior. I saw photos and that screen hit me in the face. It's incredible.
It's really, really cool. So the car that we tested was the top spec Captor Intense, and it comes with a 9.2 inch vertical, I want to say Tesla style, but it's not quite that big, touchscreen on top of the dashboard. And that is one of the highlights. It's quite unique in the segment in that it really looks upmarket. It's got some really slick graphics. The touchscreen itself is maybe a little bit slower and a little bit blockier than I would have liked, but it's certainly not far off the pace. And an optional $2,000 pack also brings you what is a really modern digital instrument cluster in front of the driver. So I'd be ticking that option box as well. But beyond that, a lot of the things where maybe some of the other sort of expensive small crossovers fall down, like the materials on the doors, the material on the seats, the design of the dash, Renault has put a lot of thought into. So it looks really cool. It's got a cool sort of dual tier storage space on the transmission tunnel. Everything you touch feels good. The doors are trimmed in soft touch material. The dash is trimmed in soft touch material. The steering wheel feels expensive. Renault hasn't really skimped, and it shows. It really looks, it has a really unique look, and it also feels just as special as that look would suggest.
How about in terms of practicality, Scott? The Captor's grown a little bit compared to the last one. So what's like rear passenger space like and boot space like for, you know, say a young family with kids in the back? How is that going to work out for them?
So it's on the bigger side for a small SUV, and that means that boot space is good. It's got a dual tier floor. So you have the floor flat to start with, and it looks quite small, but you can actually take the floor out and drop it right down, and that opens up quite a useful space. And rear seat space is good for a car of that size. I am not normal height, and I could sit behind a reasonably sized adult in the front. I had good headroom in the back. And if you're not using those back seats or you've got a very short person sitting in them, you can also slide that rear bench forward to free up even more boot space. So in terms of that segment, it stacks up quite well. It's still not as big as an X-Trail or the previous Kadjar in the back, but it's a smaller car on the outside as well. So, compared to the related Duke and some of its other rivals, it really feels quite grown up in the back seats and the boot.
Did you find any areas where there could be some room for improvement?
I did. So I think to start with, when we're talking the interior, although it's all really well put together, there's a couple of, call it Renault quirks. That wing-style storage space where the transmission tunnel is, if you knock it with your knee, and I know Mike and I both had this problem, it feels quite wobbly and quite loose. The gear selector's a little bit sort of toy-like as well, and I also really found myself not knowing if I was in drive or reverse, for example. You've got to think about it a bit more than you otherwise would. But wow, that stuff would also come with familiarity. So not marking it down too much for that. In terms of how it drives, it's actually quite a hard car to fault compared to some of its rivals. So the engine is awesome, and it really makes a difference having some more power under your right foot. And even though it's quite a small engine with a dual clutch transmission, which is kind of sometimes a recipe for disaster, it's reasonably smooth in town. It doesn't lurch too much away from the lights. It doesn't feel jerky between first and second gear. When you're up and on the move, it's also clever enough and fast enough to put you in the right gear at the right time. So I think one of the things that varies quite widely in small SUVs like the Captor is what's under the bonnet. You've got everything from quite a small hybrid powertrain in the Toyota CHR to the Atmo 2-litre Boxer in a Subaru XV, all the way through to what is quite a powerful turbocharged engine in the Captor. And the Captor really feels quite grown up in that regard. There's a bit of road noise, which is probably one of the things that we noticed about the car that wasn't as good. It's on Continental tyres, and I'm not sure if it's down to the tyres, down to the noise insulation, but when you get it on Australia's, call them average, B roads, especially in regional Vic, or as you get out of Melbourne where it's quite, you know, big coarse chip stuff, it can feel quite noisy in the car. Beyond that, it's a really, really solid car that sort of, it finally has the driving dynamics to match the way it looks in the interior.
Yeah. Wow. Sounds like a big improvement. You've given it a car expert rating of 8.1. That article and Paul Marek's video of it is now up at the site. Now, Scully, I thought while you're here, we'd love to talk to you about your time driving the Mazda MX-30M Hybrid. What were your first impressions of its looks and its drive?
I'm curious to open this up to everyone because I'm really impressed with the way it looks. Having now seen it in person, had a play around with it and seen some of the different colors, I wasn't quite sold on it in the photos, but it's got quite a unique profile. And in Sol Crystal Red with a black roof and silver highlights on the roof rails, it's really quite distinctive in a way that very few cars are. I'm also open to being told I'm wrong on that one, though, so I am curious to hear what you guys have to say.
No,
I was the same as you, Scully. I didn't like it when it first came out with the launch photos, but now we've sort of got it here and I've seen actually normal photos that haven't been doctored. It looks great. Those freestyle doors, I think what Mazda call them, or some people call them suicide doors, I'm actually warming to them. I don't know about you guys.
I love freestyle doors. I love the fact that you can have a side profile where both sets of doors are open and it's just this open space without any pillars. It's a really cool vibe. It's very reminiscent of, the BMW i3 comes to mind, but it's also harking to Mazda's past, isn't it? Because, of course, the RX-8 had those doors as well. And I guess when you think about it, the modern version of a sporty style statement is a crossover SUV. So this is kind of the zeitgeist of the 21st century zeitgeist iteration of what the RX-8 was. Design-wise, it grew on me. I think there's some fussy shut lines and things that you get from that extra set of doors. But overall, definitely stands out. And, you know, Mazda's all kind of, it's a bit like Audi and other brands, BMW, where a lot of their products have very similar design cues to one another. But you're not going to mistake this vehicle for any other Mazdas. Yeah.
I think that's one of the things to note about it, because what stood out to me when they launched it was the fact it's an MX. And previously that's been the MX-5 and the MX-6, which didn't last nearly as long. But that means Mazda experimental. And in the Mazda world, that means this is the car where they try some stuff that maybe they wouldn't try elsewhere. So I was a little bit confused about that to start with. But having now driven the car and seen it in person and played with the doors and the interior and that sort of thing, it makes a bit more sense.
On the subject of design, for me, I'm still not 100% sold on the exterior. I think it kind of looks like, you know how Lego and Mega Bloks do versions of production cars? This kind of looks like a Mega Bloks version of the CX-30. So because Mazda's design language has been so fluid and elegant for so long, and, you know, really like organic lines and these beautiful waves and, you know, muscular haunches and things like that. And I feel like this is a little bit blocky and jagged and whatnot. But what actually still impresses me from the moment it launched, and I'm hoping when I see it in person that I'll get the same feeling, is just how cool that interior is. So, Scott, I know that they're using some really cool materials that are sustainable, or, you know, they break it up a little bit. They've even got like cork or something. So I don't know how many wine bottles they had to pop to actually line the interiors of these cars. But can you tell us a little bit about, like, you know, Mazda's really pushing that premium for the people thing that they've been doing for a little while. Does the MX-30 sort of have that upmarket feel to match the look?
For the most part, it does. So we've actually been lucky enough to speak with the project director for the MX-30. She's a really interesting woman who started as a test driver at Mazda and now ran the MX-30 project. She's now off to be the head of HR for Mazda Japan, which is an interesting career path. She was a fascinating person to talk to. And she kept coming back to this idea of making this a relaxing, comfortable space to be. And often that is kind of marketing speak. We hear it off, you know, all the time from car makers that they've gone for a certain thing and then the interior is completely conventional. But in the case of the MX-30, it kind of rings true. So even the base model, the Evolve, has interesting tweed style trim on the seats. They all have cork on the transmission tunnel, which is a nod to Mazda's past as a cork company based out of Hiroshima. And it's really, really interesting as a material. It's also quite eco-friendly compared to some of the other stuff that we're used to. And it also, like, it's got some touches that you wouldn't necessarily expect, like an Audi-style floating screen for climate control, although it does also have physical buttons on the side, which is awesome. Really rate that highly. It definitely is an interesting take on Mazda's current interior design sort of formula. And it moves the game forward a little bit from the Mazda 3 and the CX-30, which are really nice places but quite conventional. This just has a bit of a different feel to it. It's like a more of a sort of like a BMW i3, I suppose, in some senses, which is very luxurious but also puts a unique spin on.
Now, Scully, just quickly, I know that the main thing about this car is its electric drivetrain, but we're not actually talking about the EV right now because Mazda's decided to launch a petrol one for the first, and the EV is coming in a few months' time, but the petrol one is called M-Hybrid. Now, my understanding of this is that the word hybrid is rather loosely applied, to be generous about it. Can you just tell us a bit more about the drivetrain?
Yeah, so on a scale from mild to spicy, this is a butter chicken. It is the mildest of mild hybrids. So it's a 24-volt system. So it's able to recoup energy when you lift off the accelerator or brake the car. It's also able to use that energy for smoother start stops. When you lift off at 20 k's an hour and come to a stop, it can turn the engine off. And it can provide a little bit of a torque and a power boost when you put your foot down. In reality, it feels like a slightly smoother version of the normal 2-litre Mazda engine, which is not necessarily a bad thing because although it doesn't have the most incredible output, it's got just over 110 kilowatts and it's got 200 newton metres of torque, that's pretty par for the course when you're talking, you know, relatively small, relatively inexpensive style focused crossovers. I know we've just hopped out of the Captur, which is more powerful, but the Mazda doesn't feel woefully underpowered. But when you look at the rest of the car, which is so unique with those freestyle doors, with the interesting exterior and interior design, it just doesn't quite have the same sort of sense that it's innovative or interesting or exciting. And that's where that electric version is going to come in when it arrives before the middle of the year. And it's also where the rotary range extender, which is going to be revealed early in 2022, will come in.
How did you find the cabin space, Scully?
Really, really good in the front. Mazda has set it up so you can drop the seat right down to the floor, which I love. It sort of feels a bit racy and more interesting than sitting right on top like you do in, say, a Ford Puma. The rear space is a bit of a mixed bag. Getting into a car with those freestyle doors is actually quite easy because rather than having to sort of sneak around the front of the door and then slide in, you can just walk straight in and sit down. And despite the size of the sloping roof, headroom is pretty good for someone of my height as well. Legroom is not great, though. You really wouldn't want to be sitting tall people back there. Or, I mean, I'd go so far as to say you wouldn't want to be sitting short adults back there for much longer than you'd have to, which is, again, often the case with cars like the CHR and the Puma. They're more designed as style statements than they are as really practical family carriers. And the MX-30 falls into that category probably even more because of those unique doors. But compared to previous cars with freestyle doors, Mazda says it's put real effort into making the window larger, into moving the seatbelt mounting, and into making it a little more practical than, say, the RX-8 was. And, I mean, in person, those efforts have paid off to a degree, but you're still making some sacrifices for the fact it's a cool-looking car with some cool details.
If you're keen to read more, that review is live now at carexpert.com.au. Thank you very much, Scott Colley.
Thanks, guys.
That's a wrap for this week's podcast. What content can we look forward to coming up over the weekend, J-Wo?
So we've got a couple of embargoed reviews for some new SUVs. So I've been driving the updated Volkswagen Tiguan this week in its base 110 TSI life trim, which will go live on Friday. So by the time the podcast is published, it'll be live over the weekend. And on the same day, Paul Marich is going to be publishing a review on the updated Jaguar F-Pace. So that's some new exciting metal coming into Australia that we will have content on very shortly.
Fantastic. And Moko, what cars have we got coming up over the following week?
Got some pretty interesting metal in the garage at the moment. We have a 76 series Toyota Land Cruiser. So that's the old boxy, but it's the 5-door version. So that's I had a quick drive in that. It took me back to my childhood on the farm driving those things. It was very, very fun indeed. I'm doing a comparison at the moment with the Hyundai Venue versus the Kia Stonich, two overpriced, small, high-riding crossover SUVs. Long year in a BMW X7, X30 Drive, X30,
nice.
X-Drive 30D, I should say. What a mouthful. what else is coming up? We've got, I'm doing another twin on the Mazda CX-5 versus the outgoing Lexus NX. We've got the Subaru XV Hybrid that we're revisiting. The i30 Sedan N-Line Premium from Hyundai. So definitely focusing on those volume-selling cars, but the garage, as ever, is bulging with new metal. So keep an eye out for all those reviews.
Sounds absolutely chockers. If you would like to contact us, our email address is podcast@carexpert.com.au. Thank you very much, Mike Costello and James Wong.
Awesome to be with you guys. Thank you as always.
Thanks, Mandy.